Good morning. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. It's 10 minutes past 8 o'clock on this Friday morning, June the 29th, and it's time for our Friday Week in Review, the last one for the month of June. Every Friday after 8, we welcome in two guests from different perspectives to talk with you about the news of the week. We cover the major political news of each week, and today we have Matt Rothschild, editor of the Progressive Magazine, with us, and Kevin Hermaning, the former chair of the Marathon County Republican Party. And we welcome you to join in with the news this week that most mattered to you. 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, in Madison, 263-1890, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm sure we'll talk about the immigration legislation that was defeated in the Senate. We'll talk about universal health care being proposed in Wisconsin and much more. Let me welcome in our guest. Matt Rothschild, editor of the Progressive Magazine, is also the author of a new book, You Have No Rights, Stories of America in an Age of Repression. Good morning.
Hey, Joy. Thanks for having me back on.
And we will be talking with Matt about his book a little later in the month. We'll devote a whole hour to that. Also joining us, Kevin Hermaning, former chair of the Marathon County Republican Party. And he joins us by telephone. Good morning.
Well, good morning, and thanks for having me on again.
Yes, thanks for being with us. You know, Matt, I mentioned to you just before we went on the air, the last time I saw you, you were hobnobbing with Robert Redford at the Sundance Theaters in Madison when they opened. He came for a visit. How is Bob these days?
Well, now you're embarrassing me, Joe. it was fun to be there, though, and my wife had a big thrill because she's been a huge Robert Redford fan all her life. And so anyways, we just talked to him for about 2 minutes. We were in receiving line like at a wedding or a bar mitzvah.
Well, it was, I think it was when I was on vacation and I saw the coverage on television. And then Kevin Hermaning, I haven't seen you, I don't think, in a very, very long time. But I hope to see you sometime because, you know what, I hope that we can bring the Friday Week in Review on the road sometime. Even my bosses don't know that this is a desire of mine, but I'd like to come to Wausau and do the Week in Review there. And
share Glenn Moberg's microphone then.
Yeah, that's true. He's up there doing stuff. But I think, you know, just do it in the morning as we usually do, but
sure.
Kind of run around. So anyway, I should have mentioned that Kevin Hermaning not only is the former chair of the Marathon County Republican Party, he's a former Iranian hostage and currently a financial planner in Wausau. Let's review some of the news of the week. Let's start with the immigration bill. The immigration bill was defeated in the U.S. Senate, and now many are saying it's dead until after the next presidential election. Are you happy about that, Kevin Hermaning, or not?
Well, I think certain aspects of it are very satisfying to me, like the fact that this really was an amnesty bill. It was not really a national security bill, nor a piece of legislation that would have assured not only the corporations the opportunity to hire folks who are willing to do jobs that a lot of Americans, frankly, aren't willing to do, but also to pave a real path toward legalized citizenship. And it really sends the bill that was defeated was sending the wrong message. It was sending the message that if you break the law, we're going to forgive all of the sin and basically open the floodgates for the next round, because we have no ability to still, nor will as a nation, to secure the border.
Mm-hmm. Matt, what do you think about the defeat of this immigration legislation?
Well, to me, it shows Bush's weakness. I mean, this was one of the few domestic initiatives he really tried to put some of his political credibility, or political capital, as he likes to call it, behind. And, you know, his political support is solidified down at about 28 degrees. So he doesn't have a lot of leverage here. And it just shows him to be a weak president. I don't think he helped himself by pushing the bill. The bill itself is not one of those things that I get really agitated about, because I saw good things and bad things in the bill. I thought it would bring immigrant workers here only for 2 years at the behest of companies. They would be essentially indentured servants. They couldn't really speak up for their rights for fear that they'd be sent back packing. I don't think it was amnesty per se. I mean, a lot of these 12 million immigrants have been here a long time, and are they just supposed to be in legal limbo forever? So I thought it was good on that side. But what this really came down to, ultimately, though, there were a few liberal Democrats like or independents like the socialist Bernie Sanders of Vermont voted against it. What it came down to was, I'm afraid to say, some really ugly racism on the part of people at the grassroots who lobbied their Republican senators and got the message from right-wing talk radio and Lou Dobbs and Rush Limbaugh and put a lot of heat on their officials, and so the officials caved because the vote this time was a bigger defeat for Bush than it was last time.
Actually, to put the context into proper direction, only three-quarters of the Republicans in the Senate voted to derail the bill, as you probably know. So this was a bipartisan effort to defeat a bad bill. That's really what this was all about. I mean, when you have Ted Kennedy and George Bush signing up for the same side of things, there has to be something going on. But really, it was George Bush got his immigration views and his he basically was, you know, weaned on the idea that immigrants from Mexico are an important part of the economy of the United States, certainly of Texas, as he was growing up. It is true, and it's important. But there are companies every day who are asking for waivers from the U.S. government and getting them granted to bring in folks from all parts of the world, whether it's for technology jobs or medical jobs or whatever. And so really, the folks, it's only 13% of the people in our country supported this bill. Three times that many opposed it. Now, granted, that leaves half the people who had no clue what it was about. And so it naturally resonated with the idea that they were going to be able to get into our Social Security system and start drawing benefits from a defunct program. There are so many things that were bad about this bill. Of course it was defeated.
Let me get a caller in on this, and we'll continue. Craig in Onalaska. Hi, Craig.
Good morning. My comment is that one of the reasons that I was very pleased to see that the bill was defeated is the fact that our president has never picked up the telephone, called the president of Mexico, and explained to him that the American public is not pleased with having unlimited number of illegal aliens come into our country. And that's not a racial thing. That's just the fact that we cannot have unlimited numbers of people coming from all over the world and entering and staying and, costing us money as far as education, health care, housing. I'm not opposed to having people come and work. If they want to come and we have the jobs available for them, let's do it legally. Let's hire them in Mexico or Canada or the Europe, wherever they need to come from. But let's not just have unlimited numbers of people coming across the borders, disobeying Mexican law to get into the U.S., disobeying American law. It just doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, Matt?
Well, to Craig's point, I mean, it would be odd for Bush to call up the president of Mexico and talk to him about this problem because Bush, like his predecessor Bill Clinton, fostered NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, which has inspired millions of Mexicans to come to this country, inspired them not for the lofty ideals of America, but because they need help. They need economic help because NAFTA has devastated the economy of Mexico and ruined the Mexican farmers there who can't compete with the corn coming in from the United States. And then, you know, these U.S. companies set up shop along the border, and then, oops, it's cheaper in Mexico, so they go to Mexico, and that leaves people unemployed, and they have to find work, and so for rational reasons, and it takes a lot to get people to leave their home country. For rational reasons, they take the risk of leaving their home country and uproot themselves to come here so they can provide for their families. And the idea that it's costing us money, study after study has shown that immigrants actually don't cost the United States money over time, that through taxes, they are more than paying for themselves and paying for the social services that they get. And the idea that Kevin mentioned that only 3/4 of the Republicans voted against the president's wishes is a huge concession. And I do just want to return quickly to this point that I was trying to make about bigotry behind some of this. Even Lindsey Graham, the Republican senator from South Carolina, said there's racism in this debate. Nobody likes to talk about it, but a very small percentage of people involved in this debate really have racial and bigoted remarks. And I think right-wing talk radio fueled those.
Kevin?
Well, I think the reason that only three-quarters of the GOP senators supported the bill is because it's a flawed bill. It's a bad bill. And it appears that, based on Craig's comments from on Alaska, we're probably on the same side on this issue by and large. Actually, President Bush had met frequently with Vicente Fox, the former president of Mexico, and has talked to President Calderon of Mexico about protecting the border or limiting access, yet they know that their economy is in such shambles. It's not because of NAFTA. The economy of Mexico has been a horrible economy. It is one of the least free economies in the world and has been for 30 years, long before NAFTA. And that's why people are wanting to come to the United States for opportunity. I have nothing against folks wanting to come here for opportunity. It's just follow the direction, follow the rules. Relax the immigration rule, the number of legal immigrants who we would allow to come here. But really, they're just coming here for the opportunities without very many of the responsibilities.
Yeah, let me get one more caller in on this. Larry in Madison. Hi, you're on the air.
Thank you. The immigration bill was more than 400 pages in length. I'd like to know what the guests think about the Senate leadership's methods in trying to get it passed. For example, bringing it to the floor without any committee hearings. Thank you.
Matt?
Well, I think Harry Reid was really ambivalent about this, Larry. I mean, he was the one who pulled it off the table the first time and only brought it back under pressure from Bush. I think he understood that there were good parts of the bill and bad parts of the bill, and he also can add. And I think he understood that the thing wasn't going to pass, and he didn't want to waste any more time on it.
Kevin?
Six Democrats switched their votes, 12 Republicans switched their votes of the ones who voted to move ahead with the bill. And so, you know, they realized that it was too fast, too soon, and it was a flawed bill. I mean, that's the message here. I agree. President Bush is a lot weaker today than he was 5 years ago, even than he was a year or 6 months ago. That's not the reason that the Republican senators are opposed to the bill. It's because it was a bad piece of legislation.
We are talking with Kevin Hermaning and Matt Rothschild, our two guests this week for our Friday Week in Review. We're done with the immigration bill now. What else do you want to talk about that happened in the news this week? 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. In Madison, 263-1890. Or send an email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. Glad you're with us for this Friday Week in Review for this Friday, June the 29th. Coming up this afternoon, Jean Purcell in for Ben Marins after 4 for your views on the news. That's after 4 o'clock this afternoon. We are reviewing the news of the week with Matt Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, Kevin Hermaning, former chair of the Marathon County Republican Party, and with you, we welcome your topic of interest during our Week in Review at 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. And let's talk some about, Matt, an issue I know that you wanted to talk about this week. We had the chairman of the House and Senate Judiciary Committees blasting the White House this week over its latest move in the fired prosecutors controversy. The White House today asserted executive privilege in rejecting a congressional subpoena for documents related to the firing of federal prosecutors. Also, committees looking into the warrantless wiretapping issue, issuing subpoenas, wanting more information on that, and the White House is saying no. What do you think? Oops, that's the wrong button.
The White House is going down the Richard Nixon slide right now, Joy. I mean, Article 3, one of the three articles that Nixon was impeached for, spoke directly to this. I mean, it spoke to Nixon not supplying the documents that the Judiciary Committee in the House was supplying. Let me just read it a second. Richard Nixon has failed without lawful cause or excuse to produce papers and things as directed by duly authorized subpoenas issued by the Committee on the Judiciary and willfully disobeyed such subpoenas in refusing to produce these papers and things. Richard Nixon, substituting his judgment as to what materials were necessary for the inquiry, interposed the powers of the presidency against the lawful subpoenas of the House. So this is real tricky legal territory for Bush here and for Cheney, too, because some of Cheney's papers have been subpoenaed. And I'm glad, finally, that the Democrats in Congress are issuing subpoenas and trying to bring this to a head, because we have had a lawless runaway administration here, and it's about time that members of Congress tried to exercise their rights and restrain this presidency and vice presidency the only way the Constitution establishes. And that would be, first of all, to investigate as it is now, and I hope it will lead to impeachment hearings.
Kevin Hermany.
Well, the difference between what's happening now and Watergate is that laws were broken during Watergate, and the wiretapping and some of the other things have been ruled constitutional and legal by this judiciary these days. And so the fact that the White House does not want to release internal discussions and communications as it relates to firing the judges, I mean, the prosecutors, that's their right, that's their privilege. How many federal prosecutors, U.S. attorneys, were fired for no reason whatsoever by Bill Clinton, his administration? It's part of what they're allowed to do. They serve at the pleasure of the president. And the fact that eight of these prosecutors were let go with no basis of illegality, just because people didn't like the fact that they were let go, or just because they were in the midst of, in a couple of cases, of some prosecutions, they aren't the only people working on them. There was nothing illegal about what the Bush White House did in this area.
Well, I beg to differ on this. I mean, on the prosecutor question, you know, they do serve at the pleasure of the presidency, but that doesn't mean they are allowed to go do the president's bidding to prosecute people for the crassest political reasons on false charges to distort the outcomes of an election, to tilt the election toward the Republican Party. I mean, that is corruptive of our democratic system at its most basic. Let me just finish here a second. And also, Kevin, you said laws were broken in Watergate. They weren't broken here. And you said judges have said the wiretapping is legal. Actually, the only judge who has ruled on this is Judge Taylor of Detroit, who said it was a flagrant violation of the First Amendment, the Fourth Amendment, the separation of powers, the NSA wiretapping. John Dean, famous in Watergate, said that when Bush said he's not going to abide by the FISA law, and let's be clear, the FISA law says the exclusive means by which the NSA can spy on U.S. citizens here is with a warrant from the FISA court. When Bush said he's not going to do that and signed a document every 45 days that he wasn't going to do that, John Dean said this is the first time a president has confessed to an impeachable offense.
Yeah. Let me ask you, Kevin Hermany, what do you make of Vice President Dick Cheney asserting that he is not a part of the executive branch of our government and does not then have to comply with a presidential executive order requiring agencies in the executive branch to supply information on national security issues to the National Archives? The vice president is not a member of the executive branch of government?
No, I think most people are of the belief that the president and vice president both are part of the executive branch of government. And obviously there is a lot of politics on both sides of the equation here. When all is said and done, the vice president will back down and will realize, I'm assuming, will realize that if they can get as much mileage as they can out of the political side of this, just like the Democrats are doing in the Congress, the Senate, and the House, they always back down when they get pushed at the end, but they're going to hold out as long as they can. And it's, you know, whether it's talk radio on the right or talk radio or the mass media on the left, it really doesn't matter. Both sides are going after the opponents, and we supposedly, after the last election, we're going to have a more unified government, and of course that isn't the case at all.
Matt? Well, this revelation on Cheney just shows people how creepy our vice president is. This guy thinks he's above the law. He's found a fourth branch of government to crawl out on. I mean, his fingerprints are all over the Bush crimes, and you don't have to dust too long to find them. There's a series in the Washington Post this week that has Cheney putting a document in front of Bush's nose to sign that Bush, you know, barely read and wasn't vetted by anyone else in the executive branch that you know, said that the United States could, you know, go after these Al-Qaeda types or alleged Al-Qaeda types and, you know, disappear them, essentially. We have a runaway renegade vice president here. He's a Shakespearean figure who manipulates behind the throne because there's a president who has really given him enormous power and is too lazy to do the work himself.
Let me get one call in on this, and then we will move on to another topic. Stephen Phillips, hi, you're on the air.
Hi. Yeah, I was. I agree with your guest on Dick Cheney. This guy needs to be in prison. I mean, this is the reason we were given the right to bear arms. So when our government got too powerful and was breaking the law, we could march into the White House and oust them. I think we're beyond impeachment. We need.
Well, I'm going to take that call off the air. What's your reaction to that call, though? I guess that anger, that almost hatred, Matt Rothschild.
Well, you know, I'm not for guns, period. So the idea of taking up arms does not really thrill me in any way, shape, or fashion. I believe we need to exercise our constitutional powers under Article 2, Section 4, which says the president and the vice president and other high officials, to my mind, that includes Gonzalez, if they commit high crimes and misdemeanors, that they can be impeached. And I think it's clear that they have. I think there's a huge frustration among people who are aware of what Dick Cheney has been doing in this country, that this man has been able to get away with it for so long. And maybe that's what was getting at Steve.
Yeah. Do you want to comment, Kevin Hermany?
Well, you know, the vice president does not hold the sway that he once did in the White House. And the president is trying to hang on to or create a legacy that will be long-lasting. He's lost a lot of his conservative base on some important issues, particularly the immigration bill. But the reality is that Republicans, by and large, continue to stand by and support the president and believe that he's got a great legacy tied to national security, a lot of social issues that are very important to social conservatives. And let's face it, the economic climate of this country is and has been for a long time among the best that it's ever been, with most boats being raised.
Let me just talk to the legacy real quick. The legacy is this disaster in Iraq, the incompetence and malfeasance at Katrina, and he let 9/11 happen, and because he, you know, went back and cleared brush for 5 weeks when he was warned that Al-Qaeda was about to attack, and he hasn't found the guy yet. So, I mean, that's his legacy.
Let me switch gears. This week on Hardball with Chris Matthews on MSNBC, Chris Matthews was talking with Ann Coulter, the conservative author, commentator, who has made some very, very controversial statements in the past, including calling presidential candidate John Edwards the F word. She's also made comments that John Edwards was exploiting his dead son for sympathy votes and other things. During that program, his wife, Elizabeth Edwards, called in to confront Ann Coulter. And here's part of what Elizabeth Edwards said.
In the South, when we when someone does something that displeases us, we want to ask them politely to stop doing it. I'd like to ask Ann Coulter, too, if she wants to debate on issues, on positions. We certainly disagree with nearly everything she said on your show today. But it's quite another matter for these personal attacks.
And this is Ann Coulter's response.
So you have all the time in the world to respond.
I think we heard all we need to hear. The wife of a presidential candidate is asking me to stop speaking. No.
Matt Rothschild, what should Ann Coulter stop speaking?
Well, you know, I'm for free speech, even for Ann Coulter. But she is vile. I mean, and, you know, she also said that the 9/11 hijacker should have sent a plane into the New York Times building. I mean, you know, this woman gets a forum for reasons that are absolutely beyond me. I don't know if it was necessary for Elizabeth Edwards to call up Ann Coulter, but it's good for people to stand up to this kind of a vicious personal attack that seems to know no boundaries?
Kevin Hermaning?
Well, there are so many places to go on this. Ann Coulter, the reason she gets a forum is because she has she's just published her fifth best-selling book and has sold more than 5 million copies of her most recent book, Godless, in which she talks about the secular progressives gaining control, increasing control in our country. She's obviously a very provocative speaker and individual, but I would say this. The bottom line is that the comments that Ann Coulter made the other day on Chris Matthews' show Hardball have been completely taken out of context. All she was saying was that a couple of years ago, folks had said on the Democratic and liberal side that they wished that Dick Cheney had been killed in an assassination attempt over in Afghanistan. And she was merely saying, well, I guess that the only free and right speech in this country is to accuse individuals. So if she had said herself that if John Edwards was killed by a terrorist, that then that would be protected and it wouldn't be criticized. She was merely responding to the type of speech that is not criticized by individuals who apparently favor free speech, but only if it's the right speech. So it's the context that was completely removed from this discussion. And Elizabeth Edwards was given an invitation to come on and speak. Once the spouse interjects him or herself into the debate, of the political debate, then the political spouse needs to stay in the debate, and she was given an opportunity, personally invited herself by Bill O'Reilly last night to come on the air, and she's refused to respond.
Well, Bill O'Reilly is hardly a neutral forum there. I mean, I've been on that show a couple times. I mean, it's a stacked deck.
He also has 10 million viewers a year, so you can't dismiss it, which is obviously why you went on it, Matt.
Yeah, but I'm not going on it anymore because it's just not a fair forum. And to go on there and to deal with his style of inquisition there, I mean, who wants to subject themselves to that when you're cut off every 10 seconds?
But he called you a stand-up guy. I did
thanks for remembering that.
A stand-up guy. Well, we actually had a caller who couldn't hold, who wants to know, and I guess I'll direct this to you, Kevin Hermaning. Are conservatives getting tired of defending Ann Coulter?
No, we just want to make sure that things are taken in and put into context. That's all. As far as Ann Coulter is concerned, again, obviously she has gained a forum and she's invited onto programs on the left and the right because of what she writes, because of the success of her viewpoints. She has a nationally syndicated column that appears all across the country, and newspapers on the left and right are publishing her. And of course, she's an author of 5 best-selling books.
Yeah, John Edwards has put Ann Coulter's remarks and this controversy on his website, and now some are criticizing the Edwards campaign for using this as a fundraising tool. Is that out of line, Matt Rothschild?
Oh, I think, you know, anything is fair in this, and if he thought it was to his advantage that Elizabeth Edwards stood up to Ann Coulter, you know, he has every right to use it. He's trying to gain a little ground here because he's been slipping with Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama there, and so Edwards is trying to use anything he can, I think, at this moment. Mm-hmm. He's going to be overshadowed in the fundraising race, I think, today when those dollar figures come out with Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama bringing in scads and millions of dollars.
Let me bring one more call.
Could I just comment on that?
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting. I was actually thinking about this when I first heard about the Chris Matthews thing with Coulter and John Edwards' wife, Elizabeth. It's almost as though Ann Coulter would prefer to have John Edwards as the opponent for the Republican candidate to run against next year. And so she perhaps is trying to elevate John Edwards' campaign fundraising against Senators Obama and Clinton. So perhaps there's a little bit of madness behind her plan.
All right. Joe in Scandinavia.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Boy, I tell you, it's getting very difficult to listen to defenders and apologists of people like Ann Coulter and Dick Cheney. These people are really bringing down the conservative and Republican community in this country. I'm not a Republican or a conservative, but you need to have an opposition party, whether it's the Democrats or Republicans, to be a viable party. And the Republican Party, being led by Bush and Cheney and defended by people like Ann Coulter, is really destroying a two-party system in this country. And furthermore, Joy, I know that listening to your last guest, when I heard somebody, you know, your guest say that we are fighting or that people hate us because we believe in freedom, you've got to call them on that. That is just.
I don't want to go into the last hour. A guest who was giving parents advice on how to raise patriotic children. I don't even recall her making that statement. But anyway, is Ann Coulter and the defense of her, is this bringing down the conservative party, as our caller put it, Kevin Hermany?
No, any more than Jesse Jackson and Al Sharpton on the left have brought down the Democratic Party. There are folks who are more provocative, who gain a forum for based on a wide myriad of opportunities that they projected for themselves and for others, and so it's part of the political discourse. You know, in other countries, their political discourse includes fist fights in the halls of their Congress or parliaments and assassination attempts. We are very far removed from that kind of element, and the vocal discourse that happens here, I do not think is destroying the political discourse whatsoever.
Matt?
Well, I just think Joe's got a point there, Joy. If the Republican Party is going to be identified as the party of Dick Cheney, it's not going to be a party that's going to win a lot of elections if it's going to embrace, as it seems to, Ann Coulter and all her wild vitriol. I don't think it's going to grow as a party. So I don't mind that it's damaging the Republican Party. I don't mind that it's damaging the two-party system, because I hope to have more parties out there and more views available to the American public. But I can't believe that's the best foot forward for the Republican Party.
We're talking with Matt Rothschild and Kevin Hermany during this Friday Week in Review. We welcome your topics that you'd like to discuss at 1-800-642-1234 in Madison 263-1890. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. Coming up after 9 o'clock, Kathleen Dunn is with you. Kathleen holds her June open line just in the nick of time, coming up after 9 o'clock. We are talking with Matt Rothschild and Kevin Hermany, our two guests this week for our Friday Week in Review. Let's talk about the U.S. Supreme Court decision yesterday on race that dealt with school programs that used race as a way to determine where the children went to school. It was a program to integrate schools, and it was those two programs were struck down. Matt Rothschild, what do you think of that decision?
I think it's an outrageous decision. I think it's a sad day for America. It's a joke that these so-called conservative justices can still claim the mantle of being conservative in the sense that they respect settled law or precedent, because after all, it's been 53 years since Roe v. Wade. In the ensuing 53 years, the Supreme Court has defended integration efforts. The biggest case that came before the Supreme Court prior to this was in 2003 with the Michigan affirmative action plans. And in those two cases, Sandra Day O'Connor said schools could actually use race as a factor in overcoming past discrimination and in fostering diversity. She said they could keep using it for another 20 years. Boy, those 20 years went fast.
Kevin Hermany? Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I was just going to say the way to correct injustices from the past isn't to create them, but in the reverse. And I understood what you were saying. You were saying Brown versus Board of Education in 1954, not Roe v. Wade, obviously. And so the reality here is that John Roberts, when he says, what do classifying individuals for admission to public school on a racial basis have to do with equalizing or guaranteeing admission. The quote in his majority opinion, I think, is very reasoned, and I haven't seen any national studies or polls on this yet, although I imagine someone will come out with one pretty soon. But he said, and I quote, "The way to stop discrimination on the basis of race is to stop discriminating on the basis of race."
Well, what this result is going to mean is more segregation than ever. Right now, one out of six black students is in a school that is 99% black. We are going to have schools that are more separate and more unequal, if it even can come to that. And the Supreme Court had been, since Brown, recognizing that we need to do something to integrate the schools. And so this is slamming the door on integration, on the hopes of integration, on the hopes of equality in the schools. And the idea that there are only racial injustices in the past discounts the racism that exists today. I mean, one study showed that a white man who's an ex-con is more likely to get hired than a black man with the exact same credentials, except the black man wasn't in prison. You know, there have been studies that show that people call up to rent an apartment that have so-called identifiably black names. They don't get the apartment. The people with the so-called identifiably white names, they get the apartment. There is racism in this country, and this is a recognition of the need to get beyond it and the value in diversity that Sandra Day O'Connor cited just 4 years ago.
Last night, the Democratic presidential candidates held a debate, and I have Hillary Clinton talking about this court decision and race issues during that debate last night.
It is abundantly clear, especially today, that race and racism are defining challenges not only in the United States but around the world. You know, we have made progress. You can look at this stage and see an African American, a Latino, a woman contesting for the presidency of the United States. But there is so much left to be done. And for anyone to assert that race is not a problem in America is to deny the reality in front of our very eyes.
You want to react to that, Kevin Hermaning?
You would never hear a Republican candidate for president making a big point out of the idea that we now have a Latino, a woman, and an African-American presidential candidate. The fact is, they're all Americans. By separating them out based on race or gender is what is part of the problem here in our country, not part of the solution.
Well, you know, you wouldn't hear it from the Republicans because they're all white males running for president on the Republican side.
That isn't why you're not going to hear it.
Yeah. Let me get a caller in. Chris and Prentice, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, I was raised in Milwaukee at the time when they started busing. And right now, the schools in the neighborhood I grew up in, I'm white, are 75% black in the white neighborhoods. I think it's about time they reversed this. It made it hard. You couldn't go to school in your own neighborhood in Milwaukee.
Yeah. So how do you reverse this, Chris?
By not deciding who can go where by the basis of their color.
Matt Rothschild, do you want to react to that?
Well, I think Chris is talking about the experiment in busing that was an uncomfortable one for a lot of people, and we can argue over means of integration, but do we really need to say that there's no need for integration, period, and that we should just return to our segregated camps in this country? I hope that's not the case. I mean, maybe after this decision, one good thing could come out of it, and that would be we would equalize funding for education by school district instead of having across the country wealthy school districts get to pay much more money for their kids to get educated than poorer ones. But I still think this ignores the fact that racial discrimination not only exists in the past but exists in the present, and the value of diversity. And I think we're shutting the door on a lot of good things with this court decision.
Let me bring in a different...
Can I just make a comment, Troy?
Right after Kay and Maguanago does. Kay, go ahead.
Yes, I think it's we're going backwards. I mean, in 1954, all of these issues were examined, and the Supreme Court ruled on it that race was definitely an issue. And I would recommend to all your listeners the book called Simple Justice by Richard Kluger. It was written shortly after the decision. It's a hefty book, but when you read it, no matter what side you're on, you understand that what they said yesterday is undoing what Thurgood Marshall and Mr. Green and all these people who rode around in old dilapidated cars and worked their heads off and gave our country a wonderful piece of a chance. And they're going backwards.
Yeah. All right, now Kevin Hermaning.
Well, I was just going to say that program that Matt and the caller were talking about was the Chapter 220 program in Milwaukee. The difference is that was a voluntary program. And my brothers and sisters, all four of them, we're part of the Chapter 220 program, and we're bused from the south side of Milwaukee in a nearly all-white, from a nearly all-white community of Oak Creek up to the north side of Milwaukee in a voluntary program. And when things are voluntary, it's a lot different when they're, than when they are mandatory. And so what Justice Marshall talked about was trying to undo the hypocrisy and the racism of the past, but he replaced it with the racism of the present. Of course, that was 40 years ago, 50 years ago. So that is what the majority opinion talked about yesterday, is not undoing racism of the past in public institutions like public schools, but rather simply getting rid of admitting people based solely on their race.
All right, we're gonna we need to talk about some state issues this week. Monday, in fact, Senate Democrats unveiled a proposal for universal health care for all Wisconsin residents. There was a public hearing on it on Monday. It was added to the budget, and that budget was voted on and passed on Tuesday. And let's get more reaction and background from Wisconsin Public Radio's state government reporter, Sean Johnson.
Governor Jim Doyle put most of this budget together in February, but the $15 billion health care plan Senate Democrats added to it yesterday has spurred most of the debate. The proposal would be paid for through a payroll tax. It would cover all preventative care and offer generic prescription drugs for a $5 copay. Majority Leader Judy Robson says they're the same benefits lawmakers enjoy.
The same health care benefits we receive, we will extend to the rest of the state, to our employers, to employees, to our families, and to our farmers.
Democrats will also amend the budget to boost school aid for districts with low enrollment. They also want to generate more revenue by taxing corporations based on what their parent company makes instead of just the profits of a Wisconsin subsidiary. Republican Alberta Darling already had qualms with the governor's budget plan, but she says Senate Democrats made it worse.
It is just shocking to me that the Democratic senators think that they can increase all the spending in their budget up and over what the governor did. You know, the governor got elected on saying he was not going to increase taxes. I wish people would wake up. The governor did increase taxes, and now our Senate Democrats want to increase spending more.
The budget senators passed today isn't final, and there's a good chance a lot of the items they're adding will eventually get taken out. That's because they'll eventually have to reach some compromise with Assembly Republicans, who don't want new taxes and who don't support this universal health care plan. Sean Johnson, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Okay, we got a couple of things here. Let's start with Kevin Hermaning. Do you like the Democrats' universal health care proposal that's in the state budget now?
No, of course not. And, you know, not one Democrat, frankly, nor a Republican member of the Assembly or the Senate has called me as a business owner and asked me what I think about the health care proposal that they have put forth in Madison. The fact is that my business, like a lot of small businesses, provides 100% paid health insurance benefits for all of its employees. All of my people who work here have fully paid health insurance benefits by the employer, by me. And that is the case in business after business after business around the state. So what is the state going to give me a big tax credit? Quite frankly, I would probably financially profit as an individual and an individual business owner if this became law. So why don't I support this? Because I don't think the government knows how to ration out health care in what would clearly become a socialist government-controlled health care program. I don't support it. It is ridiculous that the state of Wisconsin thinks that it can do something better than private businesses can in any area at all.
Oh, man.
And private businesses have done such a wonderful job in getting everybody the health care that they need in this country when we just see the number of uninsured people go to 43 million in the United States ranking in health care down to about 37 as far as advanced industrial countries go. You know, Michael Moore's movie Sicko's coming out. I saw some outtakes from it at a hearing on Capitol Hill last week when I was in D.C., and it's an incredible movie. I think it's going to galvanize this effort toward universal health care. I'm delighted that finally in Wisconsin, the state was supposed to be the laboratory for democracy. The state of Robert La Follette that engineered a lot of the great progressive reforms 100 years ago is finally coming around to doing what Robert La Follette called on 85 years ago or 90 years ago, which is universal health care and preventive care. We need to to keep our citizens healthy and give them an incentive to be healthy before they get terribly sick and go to the ER and cost the system many, many more dollars than it's costing, it would cost them otherwise. So I applaud Judy Robson on this.
Yeah. So it doesn't look, though, like the Assembly Republicans or the Republican-led Assembly is going to go along with this universal health care. What about the rest of the budget, what the Democrats passed? Kevin Hermaning, anything stand out to you that you particularly think is important?
Well, I think that all of the tax increases ought to send a shiver through the pocketbooks of most of Wisconsin's taxpayers. Just because it's not called a tax doesn't mean it isn't an increase in cost of doing business with the government. Whether it's an increase in licensing fees for everything from recreation to driving a car or smoking a cigarette, and I've never smoked a day in my life, but if the idea is that we're going to tax people who smoke so we can put it toward health care, it seems to be a dichotomy there, and it's really just a big shift away from people who don't have the money now into the hands of the politicians who are going to spread it out to their buddies who got them elected. You know, Matt talked about Michael Moore. Michael Moore, you know, whether his movie Sicko gains any traction or not, he couldn't even keep his gig on Larry King. He got bumped by Paris Hilton.
Well, let's talk about that.
That says something about Larry King, though, doesn't it? I mean, what kind of a country is that, that a serious movie on probably the biggest or number two biggest issue on American public's mind, which is healthcare, right next to a rock there, and we're dealing with this circus celebrity. So, you know, I think the Michael Moore movie will have an effect, though, and I encourage people to see it. He told the story real quick of a mom who had an 18-year-old girl who had a high fever. The mom takes the girl to a hospital. The hospital won't take her because the mom's insurance isn't covered there, and the girl dies within 2 hours. The mom was at this hearing. It was one of the more emotional hearings I've ever been to.
Yeah, I'll have Ellen and Madison. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, I have a proposal for healthcare. I'd like to have your guest comment on. In my opinion, universal healthcare should be available for anybody under the age of 18. And then once you're once you're considered an adult, there should be a base universal healthcare plan with an option to approach the British system. That is, you can get extra or premium care if you choose to contribute extra to that plan and see the physician of your choice. And I'd just like to have your guest comment on that. And I'll take my comments off the air. Thank you.
All right. You want to start? And we were almost out of time, Matt.
Yeah, I don't see any problem with Ellen's proposal, really. I mean, I think everyone should be covered with universal health care. The question is, if you're an adult, are you still covered or can you get, coverage plus, which a lot of people are talking about in other countries. But it certainly would be a better system than we have now.
Kevin?
Well, you know, just like welfare reform was what put Wisconsin on the map, healthcare reform could help join Massachusetts in putting healthcare reform on the map. But healthcare reform should not be about taking away rights of private businesses, hospitals, physicians, and insurance companies to still employ people and pay taxes as they do. It should be about helping people who can't gain access in any other way, not about giving people to things that they could gain in a different manner.
Yeah, almost out of time. You're going to buy an iPhone, Matt? Rothschild? The iPhone goes on sale today.
I don't even have an iPod, I got to tell you, so I don't think I'm going to be in line for an iPhone today.
You're not in line either, Kevin Hermaning?
Well, $600 is a pretty steep fee, plus $100 a month to AT&T. Unfortunately, I'm in northern Wisconsin, though my 14-year-old daughter, she asked me about 3 weeks ago when she could get an iPhone, and of course, she's got to wait for any kind of phone until she's 16, like her sister did.
All right. Well, thanks to both of you for being with us. I'm going to leave everybody here with the last time we'll say Paris Hilton on this program, I promise.
Sorry.
A spoof of a song that puts new lyrics to a song that Paris actually did. Thanks to both of you. This is the Ideas Network.
Paris Hilton is waking up in her own bed in her own 2,700 square foot home this morning with the paparazzi outside. Sounds normal.
I'm sorry that I made a mistake there. Anyway, you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.